Hello.
Hello, there we go.
Hey.
Now we have sound.
All right, can you hear me?
I can. I don't know where everyone else is at. Jeanette's not here yet. Anybody else? Lawrence is there. Hi, Lawrence. Oh, hold on. Lawrence is muted. Maybe we can unmute you. Lawrence. Hi, I see you texting. I can't hear you, Lawrence, though I don't see a speaker voice. Oh, you have audio problems. Okay. I saw you had a question about marijuana. I was just thinking about that. I asked Dr. Mary Gaddy, the head of our research committee, to start researching and write an article for me to publish on the website about marijuana and memory. So we are definitely going to pursue this hotly, all the CBD oil and marijuana and all this stuff. We're going to be talking about that today because I've had a couple of cases where I'm pretty sure the marijuana is with other issues is interfering with memory access. So we will definitely be talking about that today for sure. I don't know where everyone else is at. Usually Jeanette's with us. We'll see what happens anyway. Let me text her and see what's up there.
Hi, Brent.
Hello, who is that?
This is Lawrence.
Oh, hi, Lawrence. Okay. So, are you the 312 call?
Yes.
Okay. So, we have Lawrence and a Lawrence home call. We have you on twice.
I'm going to see if I can hook the two together.
Okay. You were the 970 number also?
No, I
Yes.
have. I,
Oh, that's somebody else.
it's Scott Chaussee.
Oh, hi, Scott. How are you?
Good, and
You
you?
are you living in Tucson yet?
No, I'm still here in Grand Junction, and it's cold.
Oh, you need to be down here. I'm in short sleeves today.
Really?
Yep.
Well,
Well, it's a little cool for that, but actually, I was I rolled up my sleeves today going to the bank, so it's kind of warm.
yeah, no, I'm still considering moving. I don't think it'll be next spring. I'll probably make a decision the middle of next year, but Tucson's still a good possibility.
Potential. Good. Let me know how that goes. That would be great to have you here. We can make some referrals and deal with larger numbers here, probably.
Yeah, right. That would be nice.
Well, and I'm thinking about renting a space to see clients rather than just see them out of my home office. And maybe there's a place at the bottom of the hill available for renovation. So I might investigate that and turn that into a little trauma center or something. So we'll see.
Oh, good. Yeah, because actually you're the method that you use to clear is the best available anywhere. But there's other ways to expand on services such as their self-esteem, their core negative beliefs, their the average level of anxiety and
Right.
depression and all that. There's other ways to deal with people that aren't extremely healthy walking in and really need a complete overhaul.
Right. Yeah, that's good. Yeah, you've done some, you worked with the extremes in your facility. So, you have a lot to offer and suggest about that. So, I think we're approaching a time when we'll do a conference or something like that. Or maybe we could certainly have you talk about it here. This is probably our monthly conference call kind of thing. So we can share information that you have about that, with people in these contexts too. That's quite helpful. So that's all good. Let me see where Jeanette's
Yeah.
at. I wonder if she's a time zone freaked out or something. Let me see where she's at. Because she usually sets up the recording of everything. Well, we can always talk about things. Yeah, you can go ahead and start. Any questions that you have, okay. We'll just start talking today. How's that?
So I tried to send you a summary of the question, and I wasn't sure if that was the marijuana itself that may have been inhibiting the reframing, or if there's something else that was going on. Do you want me to read the case to everybody?
Sure.
Or
sure. That would be great.
All right, let me just pull it up. All right. So the reason I saw him was he had severe low back pain, improved with standing and moving around, worsened with sitting, needs a pillow under his legs to help sleep. He does have PTSD. When he kind of accesses those memories, they do worsen the pain, and it's improved with when he takes medical marijuana. He uses it after work, and that allows him to be functional. He is a 35-year-old war veteran from a Middle East war with the diagnosis of PTSD, no other physical or sexual traumas. The only medication he takes is the medical marijuana, no smoking or alcohol abuse. He does drink, socially, but I do know that it's more social. It's not, there isn't abuse there.
Right.
And then we're able to do a basic reframe, but it wasn't related. When I got down to his memories, one was before he went into the Army. He was 18 and was trying to decide which division to apply to. He kind of wishes he went into the Air Force or did something else. And also, after he got out at 23 and 26, when he started the trade, he wishes he had better advice and mentoring, but he couldn't do a level one where he reframed it in terms of what better happened, and he couldn't do a level two where he would like take all the younger kids or to do all the other stuff and put them somewhere else and kind of mentor them himself, the younger adults.
He was able to do that, you said?
He was not able to do that. I tried to bring him through to do that, and in all those in the different types of level two, he was not able to do it. He also was unable to do a upgrade of, let's say, his father or his mother. They're good people, but they have their own issues and their own problems.
Mm-hmm. Okay. The whole question we're talking about, folks, is we're picking up background sound from somebody.
Yes. I got it.
Okay, thanks. So the question we're dealing with is the impact. And I asked Mary Gaddy, who is the head of our research committee. We're going to do some more research, I think, in October. I'll probably be in Chicago and Naperville. And we're going to do some more quantitative EEGs, I think, in the fall in October in Chicago. And the question is, does marijuana impact the reframing of memory? How does it impact it? I'm not entirely sure. I need to talk to Dr. Kowal. And Mary Gaddy, I asked Mary Gaddy, the neurologist who's certified in HMR, to write an article for us and to do some research on the impact of marijuana and CBD on memory. It's such a hot subject right now between Canada approving CBD oil and California, Arizona, Colorado. Here, Arizona, I don't think they've approved it here yet. But I have had clients over the years. I worked on a young girl that flew in to work with me, and we could do some effective memory work Somebody is still making noise, and I'm not sure where that's coming from. If that's from your side, Jeanette, maybe?
Yes, I'm sorry.
That's okay. But we, she came in and worked with me, and she would do effective, would look like effective reframing when we were targeting specific memories. But when she'd go back to her hotel room, sometimes she would apparently go back through real active PTSD symptoms. And I'm not sure if it's from sheer quantity of PTSD that she had. We do know that what's reported is that that marijuana, the teenagers came up with the term black sleep. So we know, and I was online just checking and say, just type in marijuana affecting memory. And of course, all the you can tell the articles that are pro-marijuana users like, oh, it'll help you relax and not hold on to your memories as much, and you'll be less anxious and so on. And the teenagers came up with the term black sleep. Of course, you're sleeping better. But what it's doing is it's disrupting REM sleep. Mm-hmm. If dream sleep, where you get the greatest rest, is REM sleep, and marijuana is disrupting REM, the bottom line is marijuana before bedtime affecting your sleep states is not giving you the deepest rest that you can get. Now, you won't have the nightmares, you won't have, you know, ninjas attacking you or whatever your dream states might have been otherwise. But the truth of the matter is, yeah, you're not being attacked by the bad things from your memories, but you're not getting the positive dream rest, the sleep that you really need. It is disrupting REM. Now, I'm interested actually in the brainwave frequencies that are being disrupted by marijuana use. Dr. Jim Kowal in Chicago, with the benzodiazepines, when I said, I think it's affecting memory, he says, oh yeah, we have that research. He says like Klonopin is dropping the memory hertz frequencies, I think he said down to 50, and Xanax Klonopin, or Klonopin, and I think Klonopin was dropping it down to 50, Xanax Valium are dropping it down to like 40. So you're definitely not gonna be reframing on Klonopin and Xanax. I mean, on Xanax and Valium. Klonopin, less, little less effect, but still dropping the brain waves so low that they're not able to take in the higher frequency correction kind of a thing, imprint here. And I'm not sure about the entire mechanism, but I do know that the brainwave frequencies are slowed down so much that the reframing is not really holding. It's not able to be sustained. So that's why we eliminated benzodiazepine users from our drug. And the disclaimer that I had people sign, and the one attempted some kind of legal action against me because she claimed her pain increased after HMR. She was drinking a bottle of wine a day. She relapsed on alcohol and was using Xanax as she wanted. I don't know what it really, what her use was. So from the combination of those things, she was not really benefiting from the reframing. It probably brought up memories, brought up pain, but was not allowing her to do the reframing. But that's not our fault. That's the fact that she says, I want you to heal my memories, but excuse me, I have to go have a drink and pop a benzodiazepine right now, you know? And it's like, well, you're numbing out. That's why your psychiatrist gave you the benzodiazepines. They know it's a memory repressant drug and that it's blocking your access to the anxiety that's coming from your memories. And so I think they have some awareness of that. But I did ask Mary Gatti to investigate for me and write an article for our bit. We would like to do a video actually and put her on the website and say, this is what we now know CBD and marijuana are doing to memory access. Because if that's a group we need to include or be very cautious with, I did have some people, I think enough tobacco and also marijuana, there are quite a number of chemicals and drugs that could affect memory. Now we had a family member, and I mentioned that in one of my books, we had a friend of the family who was alcoholic and what was it that she did? She was smoking, but she got sober and had no memories come up for the first 2 years. And then at just about the 2 year mark, she decided that she stopped smoking in addition to her sobriety. And the week she stopped smoking, all of her abuse memories came up. And so apparently her first drug of choice wasn't alcohol as a teenager. It was actually cigarettes that she started smoking right after the abuse would occur in her teenage years. And it wasn't the alcohol that was the primary, it was the cigarettes. Now, was that a behaviorally bound attachment or is that actually the tobacco that's doing it? That's a separate question. But the fact was, when she stopped smoking that week, all of her flashbacks came up. And she had already been sober for 2 years and going to regular AA meetings. So it looked like the additional trigger was when she stopped the smoking. So I suppose any behavior that you use, like, oh, dude, this is just too stressful, mom and dad fighting, I'm going to smoke marijuana. Well, when you stop medicating with that, there's a chance that the memories of the fighting or the quarreling or the violence could come up if that's a substance you used or a behavior you used to medicate at the time. And so when she stopped smoking, that activated all of her repressed memories. So that was really helpful to know. So I think, yes, marijuana, certainly any behavior that numbs us out in some way could be used and create a psychological attachment. But I think there's a chemical feature to it, because if it's repressing REM sleep, it's affecting specific brainwave states. It's affecting theta is what it's doing. And if HMR, the highlight of HMR is its ability to bridge alpha theta. And these are drugs that are affecting the dream state, because you don't dream in delta, you dream in theta. And so it's actually, if it's affecting your theta states, affecting your dream states and stopping nightmares, it's blocking theta to some extent, for sure. And so if theta is also your relaxed, your REM sleep, where you get the most rest, you're not getting rest, you're going to be more anxious, higher anxiety or stress level is going to make you want to smoke more marijuana, probably, you know, but if you do that and you're not getting deeper rest at nighttime. Now, some people with flashbacks that it's keeping them awake in the nightmares and making them anxious about sleeping, it's giving them dreamless sleep, so they're getting some sleep, but it's still not. That's the whole point. In all of this drug discussion, it's not addressing the source. It's not addressing the cause and the memories. And so we do want to look at all of the things and the behaviors that are affecting the client's ability to reframe. With the clients with chronic, well, with Xanax, for instance, she could actually access where in your body, she could get the location, she could get all of the details of the top, the primary 9, 10, 11, 12 questions, and even inside, outside, shape, size, color, how young might you be? How young might you be is the 10th question. Where might you be, 11th question. What's happening, kind of 13th question. So when you get to the actual reframing portion though, and you want to change the event, they could get to the event and maybe come up with a color, but when they try to move it through the system in the body, it just doesn't create the change. It doesn't hold, it doesn't maintain. So it blocks the ability to make the correction and to sustain it in the cells and meridians of the body. It definitely puts a block on that, because a week later, monthly, the memory is still intact. It hasn't been changed, and they're bringing it up again. So as to the exact mechanism, something about we need clean access for the frequencies to create a new neural pathway. And if that is not available, then we're blocked. So anyway, back to your case, Lawrence, though, about that. I don't know if this general discussion is helpful about that. With the vets, and as to pain levels, I don't know. Mary Gaddy, the neurologist, I need to talk to Mary about how marijuana might impact pain levels per se. That I really don't know about. But as far as marijuana being used, I think the whole question is going to revolve around what is the role of the theta brainwave frequencies and access to that. Because I believe the scientific explanation would be marijuana is blocking theta. So it's blocking your deepest state of rest, increasing anxiety. I don't know if it prevented her from reframing the memories she worked on, but there were other memories that went active. It felt like boundaries were also very damaged. So it was very easy after we did reframing to just flow into almost like a borderline thing, to flow into another group of memories very quickly. So anything, Lawrence, that you have about that, questions that you have specific to this discussion? Jeanette, are you there?
I am.
You need to unblock Lawrence. He's trying to talk to us. Lawrence.
I did. Wait a minute. Here we go. Is he on the phone?
He's on a phone. And
okay, I just unblocked him. He's good.
Okay, Lawrence, can we hear you? I still don't hear anything from Lawrence.
He's still blocked.
Okay, yeah. Wait a minute. I'll unblock this one.
I think he's the 970 number.
Oh, okay. Let's try that. Try now, Lawrence.
No, this is Scott. You just unblocked me.
Okay, sorry. So try 801.
That one's unblocked.
Okay. Lawrence, are you still there with us?
Okay, I've got a message from it. It says the 7711. That's okay. All right, let's try that.
You got it. Okay.
Sorry, Lawrence.
Okay. Is there anything else with the technique? If it isn't the marijuana, was there something in the technique, or is there a different approach? Is it my approach then for doing it, or is it needed a level 3? Because I haven't gotten there yet.
No, I don't think you have any. Has he been able to use color in any way to create safety and breathe it through his body or move that through his body? The identification of level 3, just as a reminder, in 3 to 5 successive sessions, you can't move any color, sound, feeling, or vibration through any part of the body. Then you ask, how far away would you need to move your body, project your body in front of you, before you can move a color or a feeling through it? And they'll give you a distance, usually. I can't imagine any color, feeling, sound going through any part of my body. Okay. How young are you when it's not safe to have feelings in your body? And there might be a prehistory if this guy has a lot of trauma. You know, those that were attracted to military sometimes have prehistories of protection, a need to protect somebody. They have histories of violence from their family systems. You want to look at that. As to the technique, I don't know the language you were using exactly with him. Where do you think he was the most stuck? Can you see where he was shutting down the process? Was he just not able to visualize, not able to use color? Where was he blocking? Can you give me a little information about that?
A basic, he was able to use color. I was able to do a level 1 with him. Mm-hmm. It got rid of the image. It didn't really help his pain. Too much. So he was able to
let me ask you a couple of questions. Where's the pain in his body? Anywhere in particular?
Mostly in the low back, but also radiates down both legs primarily into his knees. So it's knees and low back. So there probably was actual physical damage to the cartilage from the heavy packs he had to wear, from the actual combat, from the military part. And he has the PTSD, so it can be a combination of the two of them. Biological pain plus, memory pain.
Okay. Yeah, nerve damage, we're not able to necessarily change the part that's actual physiological damage, but lower back indicates that there's probably a breach, unless it was purely a military injury. The lower back is always some kind of childhood breach and support. I usually ask, is it right side, is it left side? The lower back lumbar region is like 0 to 10, 15 years old. So it's your early childhood years, support from family members. So I'd investigate left leg, right leg, if it's both legs. If it's very physical, then it's probably damage or injury related. But if it's, if it's in the lower back, I'd look for early childhood trauma predisposing me long before military service. Lower lumbar suggests early childhood trauma predisposition, a lack of support from family. Right leg dad, left leg mom, is it right-handed? Usually is the case. So we're integrating the somatics. So I usually look at that, see if it confirms the fact that there's also some childhood breach, lack of support that led to him wanting to join the military, want to be in the military, whatever that's about. If he's from the Middle East, you said maybe a Middle Eastern culture, that presents a whole other series of challenges. Look for vulnerability on the female side, look for dominance on the male side. There's a lot that can happen culturally with that also. The bottom line principle for HMR and reframe and pain levels is do the best you can with the memories. What remains is probably physiological, and they'll have to deal with that. You can suggest acupuncture, suggest chiropractic if they have those resources. That is often quite helpful for managing it. But make sure with physical injuries like that, you reframe. So with vets, I'll just remind you, I had a person I worked on this week that did the same thing with a rape sequence. When you're listening to the client, listen to the moments of overwhelm. Listen for all of the T-1 moments in the sequence. So when the bomb goes off, you always reframe the initial shock explosion. Then when they come to and realize they're injured and are in shock, you reframe the awareness that the trauma is encoding, you know, that the emotional trauma is encoding. The physical is so violent sometimes, it is automatically emotional imprinting. So it's so scary, so violent, the body has to take a physically violent act as a T-1 moment. However, there's also the moment they come to and realize that a bomb's gone off. Like, oh my God, we've been blown up. Okay, reframe that. Then they look at their arm and realize they're bleeding severely. And then they turn and see that the guy next to them is unconscious or dead or something, and they're in shock. So you're into already three moments of encoding. And then the meds arrive, you know, medics arrive, and they're discussing what they should do and whether you're going to survive or not. And then you come to in a helicopter, and they're discussing whether you're going to live or die. Then you come to and find out that the doctor shows up and discussing what damage has occurred and whether you're going to lose your leg or not. And then they could be losing the leg and the physical therapy pain that comes after that, that comes with the physical therapy. So these are all the T-1 moments you want to be listening for. Like when you realize you're about to be raped, and then during the rape, he starts to strangle you or choke you, you realize you might die, you're encoding a second time. So you always listen for returns of the peak. Because if you're in shock and endorphins and Keflins are releasing during the fight, flight, freeze reaction, you're usually kind of numbed out. So often after the T-1 moment, the body numbs out and you really don't have much memory after that. And slowly the system comes back online. But there's usually a primary T-1 moment. But in certain sequences with vets, it's more than one moment. So what they're missing a lot with the treatment of the body is they're treating the physical body, but they're missing the complex PTSD from all of the T-1 moments that are maintaining the pain. They're missing the T-1 moments that are maintaining the sequence. Like with the vet, there's often five T-1 moments in a limited period of time. And if you don't reframe all five, you're going to be left with the pain intact on some level, because any fragment of a hologram contains the whole thing. So you want to make sure with vets or a rape sequence over a period of time, or torture, or prolonged agony or disease of some sort, suffering, like they amputate your finger, then you have to lose your foot, then you lose your leg, and then they tell you this. And anyway, it's awful with some of the diabetes sequences and surgical sequences. Cancer information, the cancers come back. Okay, now I got a second sequence here. So you want to reframe all of those moments, because any one of them is going to maintain the pain level at the time. And so a couple of things to be cautious about is it's you know, find out what the primary event was that injured his back, if you can find it. If he doesn't, talk to the back. The back bill may go to, if it's lower back, he might go to M7. Mom and dad are fighting. What happens? I intervene. I try to stop mom and dad from fighting, and he knocks me. These are actual memories from my clients. I'll always give you the real memories. They knock me into the wall, and my back is hurt, or I have a concussion. And then they stop fighting because they're worried about me a little bit, that, you know, I'm unconscious, lying on the floor. Like, hello, okay, what did you have to do to stop mom and dad from fighting? So let the body, if you get stuck, go back to the body. Talk to the body, see if the pain in the body gives you another memory or another piece to it. And remember, anytime the metaphor changes shape, size, color, intensity, vibration, it's a different memory in the sequence. It's shifted. So the pain can stay at the same time. I'm convinced you we are all going to see a client who, until we hit the 49th or 50th memory, the pain won't stop. It's just going to diminish until you get the whole sequence, and then suddenly it's gone. You're like, oh, no, there's no pain there anymore. Migraines are like that, but they're usually like two to five memories, so maybe six memories, and the migraine pain goes away. But chronic pain, vets, I'm dealing with more vets that are coming in. And I think we're going to target the vets that are being forced into retirement prematurely because of complex active PTSD diagnoses. I think we're going to go for those guys in the fall. you should be able to pull in. I mean, maybe they'd even be willing to fly in if they know the therapy's for free. I just put $2,500 for my company in the charity account to Karen, by the way. So we got a little more money. We're a little over $5,000 in our, and Gail offered also to send some funds to help us. Thank you. Appreciate that. We want to build up to at least $10,000, $15,000 for our research in the fall. Any contributions anybody wants to make are welcome or refer people to us. I'm talking to my younger sister about writing a grant. Karen, you and I will talk about that. She wants to write a grant and get her building back in downtown Baton Rouge for work with, what is she working with right now? She's helping people find jobs, but a lot of them with autism and so on are anxious and depressed. So we'd like to talk about integrating, and she's very good at grant writing. She can write a grant and get a $500,000 grant for a building in like 3 days or something. She's amazing. But talk to my sister, Carol Montgomery. I'll give you her number. And she's, you know, on a mission right now to try to get, she had a building in downtown Baton Rouge renovated with frescoes. It was a historic building. Then they took it from her and gave it to another charity department, whatever, in the state of Louisiana. And they didn't use it very well. So it's vacant right now. So she wants to write a grant, get the building back. We did a training there one time. I don't know if you were already with us at that point in time, but she sponsored us for a training in downtown Baton Rouge in that building. It's really quite lovely. And but we could do a joint project and maybe get some HMR practitioners in Baton Rouge, yourself particularly, you know, involved with something to do with helping those kids, you know, be able to maintain jobs and do some basic work with depression and anxiety. She's working a lot with autistic kids right now, but I don't think she's limited to that right now. So it's mostly about what do people need to do to keep working when they have limits or disabilities, things of that sort. And
that includes the vets.
Yeah, so we'll, yeah, exactly. And so we can talk about that. And she's very good at grant writing. She'd like to get me back in Baton Rouge, but I don't know if that's going to happen per se. I'll let you be the Baton Rouge rep. So so Lawrence, I don't know if that helped too much about the client with the marijuana thing. I'm really a little perplexed. I want Dr. Gaddy to give me some more info. She's supposed to be researching now. She's in semi-retirement. She's supposed to be researching for me, and I do want to do a video on CBD memory and memory access. I think that's a huge, huge issue coming up. And, you know, if you read about the whole CBD thing right now, I mean, it has been helpful. I'm getting feedback. It's helpful for people with neuralgias and so on. The CBD oil, neuropathy, and limbs. The CBD oil is helpful for neuropathy. It's also helpful for children and adults with seizures, apparently, that it's doing something with seizures. Although I think you should reframe your original seizure. Give me one audio. I have bronchitis from a client before Christmas. So I've had bronchitis for 2.5 weeks now. Couldn't taste anything for Christmas. Food was tasteless. Well, that was a bummer. Tasteless Christmas, anyway.
CBD is really good for OCD and anxiety and that type of thing. But, you know, again, that might be interfering with memory.
Well, yeah, exactly. Well, that's what we want to find out, what it's doing with memory. The other thing is it's not healing it. It's putting a Band-Aid on it for now. I think with the neuropathy, I don't know about the neuropathy piece. Also, to get a clinical dosage of CBD oil in the body is going to be expensive. You know, the little things they're selling, these little capsules, I mean, you're going to have to eat the whole damn pack to get a clinical dosage to actually affect memory in some way. And they don't tell you that. But I was looking up, I'm like, what's the clinical dosage in the research? It's like, I don't know, 800 milligrams or something. You're getting, what, 50 to 100 in a capsule, something like that. I'm like, you know, I don't know. This is looking kind of scary and financially ridiculous when you get down to it. So people are trying to make money off of it and build on the marijuana dependency issue. But in the end, it's all about, you know, enough with the pills and medications. Can we please speak to the memories correctly? Can we honor the body mind and honor the subconscious and talk to the memory correctly? And I get it. I had a woman, 63 years old, who's been in pain most of her life. She was in a car accident when she was 15, her back, her neck, her shoulder. She reframed the accident and the two related scenes tied to the accident. And she looked kind of like a dazed person when she walked out of the office. But there was no pain. And that just pissed me off, pardon my English, but you know, 40-something, 50-something years of pain from 15 because nobody sat down and had her do an HMR reframe and run colors through the accident. They're treating the body. They're completely ignoring the memory. They don't get the fact that if mind creates body and mind is frozen in a car accident, seeing the trauma and pain, that the person's, the body has never left a car. They never left a car accident. And so I tell people very simply, when they say, what is HMR? I said, we're not going to change your history. We're trying to teach the 95% in our latest research, your subconscious, that you're not still in the car accident. And if we can show your body you're not there, your mind will not hold on to the memory and maintain the entire trance with the pain to protect you. It thinks it's protecting you by maintaining the trance intact. But in the trance, your legs are crushed. So while your body's protecting you, it's actually maintaining the pain to protect you from the accident. What it's doing is it's sustaining the pain of the accident in your memory. So we're not changing your history. I tell clients all the time, we're not here to change your history. We're here to show your body you're not still in your history. You're not still trapped in the history. And the language I'm using, they get that part. They get it pretty quickly, actually, if you explain that to them. HMR doesn't change your history. It's talking to your 95%. HMR targets your 95, your subconscious, not your conscious mind. Your linear 5% conscious mind knows the event is over. But your 95% has never been kindly taken out of the scene to show and proven that you're not still in the car accident. And if it was a hideous traumatic event, you've never left the scene. You've never left the physiology of the original event. So yeah, so she was kind of shocked, like, oh my God. So you can see they're in a daze, like, and then they're kind of pissed off, you know, like, it was really this easy? And I've been taking pills and patches and shots and cortisone injections and doing years of therapies and acupuncture and chiropractic every week, and it took, you know, 20 minutes and running a few colors to my body to say I'm not still in the car accident. I was like, yeah, HMR is simple but very sophisticated in its simplicity, that you're sending in the missing signal to say if you can prove that you're safe and the bad thing's over, your body will release its attachment to the pain. And when she did that, it was gone, just like gone. And I'm also learning that the more you do this work and the more empathic, if you're an empath, the clearer you become, it's going to be quite interesting to see where this goes. Because I think what we're really doing is we're trying to help people move into their empathic, true, authentic empathy, that they're able to feel their pain. And if you feel, let yourself feel your pain and sense that, you can also begin to feel the pain of other people. Like I worked on a professional soccer player, retired, but professional soccer player yesterday. When I went to scan her neck, I was like, it was like five layers of burning in her neck, just burning. I just touched her body. I said, are you in an inflammatory state of some sort? Oh yeah, well, I've had a lot of inflammation in my body. I said, what was your role as a soccer player? She says, I was the, there's a name for it, the something header, which means, you know, hello, you use your head to return the soccer ball. You're like when it, they kick the kickoff, whatever, and it's flying through the air, you're like the primary person that the ball running, going 1,000 yards through the air lands on your head. So she bounced it off her head. Well, what happened, I think, over time is it shocked. She had like 10 layers of red, like layers of paper across her neck, like burning layers going through her neck. And I think I said, I think you have some kind of compacted neck trauma from your head receiving blows or injuries. Because I said, it's just, it's kind of angry, you know, ticked off your neck, it's burning. And so I said, what color would you move through your, I just did a level two. I said, what color would you move through your neck to release all of the times when the well-intentioned, you put yourself at risk and exposed yourself to neck trauma? She said, oh, I see this gray, this dark gray. I said, pewter gray? She says, yes, it's kind of like a flat gray. And as you may know from the work, every time pewter shows up, it's about boundary repair. Your boundaries have been violated. It's like a knight in armor from the Middle Ages. Whenever a knight in armor, the pewter gray color, you know, around you shows up, people with sexual abuse, physical violations will use pewter a lot. The grays and the pewter. So whenever they come up with a gray, ask, is that a good gray or what color? Is it a platinum gray? It'd be platinum gray, silver gray. She ran it through her body and the burning left. It just left. I felt the waves come out. She felt it come out. She's like, oh wow, my neck is so much more relaxed. And then went into some other concussion memories and a few other things that happened. reframe that. But she was in my office. It was very strange because she came in. She was kind of like, we're in Tucson. It's not that cold right now. But she was in this furry jacket-like thing, outfit, and she looked like she was freezing or something. I'm like, wow. But her body was burning up. So we did the reframing on her neck, released all the inflammation. At one point during the third mirror, she says, like, I'm getting really, really hot. I said, well, that's good because that means you're venting, you're releasing the heat energy from your body. Because every memory you reframe causes an increase in flow in the meridians. So typically your client's going to feel like they have better circulation. They're warmer. If they have trouble staying warm and they're always cold, then there's blockages in the meridian that prevent the energy from balancing, keeping them clear. When you clear a blockage, there's going to be a surge of heat, which she had. And then finally, at the end of the session, she's like, we did the fourth memory or group of memories. And she's like, oh, she says, I'm cool. I said, you said I'm cooling. So it's like this tingling in my hands and feet. I said, that's memory releasing. She said, it feels like it's leaving my body. And she says, now my body is cooling down. I'm really getting very cool. I said, usually that. And I said, let me show you a grounding technique to rebalance. And we did the Donna Eden's hookup. You know that from the internet, right? And you can look up Donna Eden and the hookup. It links the front and back meridians of the body. It's not my technique, but Donna gave me permission to talk about it and use it. But it links all the front and your dominant finger on your forehead, the other finger 2 inches below your navel. And it links the, actually she uses the navel. For me, I just said, I don't think it's supposed to be the navel. I think it's supposed to be the Hara line, 2 inches below the navel. And it works. It works perfectly. So maybe I modified it. But if you use the Hara line, and I worked with a guy for the past few days that does jiu-jitsu and so on. So anyway, but he's like, yeah, the Hara line links you to the, anchors you to the earth. So you're safe. You're grounded. You're secure. So the 2 points links the front and back meridians and anchors the new vibration in your body. So always at the end of the session, have a client do that to themselves. Have them link their front and back meridians and reset the system. And when they do that and they reset the system and they're grounded, anchored in their body, then usually there's a cooling down at the end and then they get used to the new frequencies. And they'll say, I feel lighter. The soccer player, she stood up, she's like, oh, I am taller. I am taller. But she got rid of all the things in her neck, the compression. I said, well, yeah, you have like 100 soccer balls on your head, you know, kind of thing. You're like compressed down from the blows to your soccer. And it was really kind of compressed and inflamed. And suddenly that relaxed. And she's like, uh-oh. And she really looked taller. I was like, I think she grew an inch or something. You know? But she looked taller, looked calmer. The inflammation was gone. And I could put my hand on her neck and it wasn't burning anymore. I felt a few heavy things shoot out. I often find I'm working with people slightly to the right of the neck and shoulder if they're right-handed. And you'll eventually feel all the releases. Every memory that reframes is different. I can distinguish between memories now, different qualities of energy releasing. So as you practice and get clearer yourself, you will pick up more and more sensation from the client's discharge, which, you know, just makes you more confident that she did what she was supposed to do and it worked. But I will give them a little feedback. I'm like, oh, did you feel a release on that? Oh, yeah, I have this thing shoot out my right neck and shoulder. And sometimes they'll say, did you feel that? I'm like, yeah, I did feel that. And I'll say it before they say, did you feel a release? Yeah, I didn't know if anybody else felt it. You know, yeah, I felt that shoot out my neck and back. So the technique is really nice energetically. I really think we want to, in the fall, I want to make sure we have a galvanic skin response measurement on the fingertips because I think we're getting more of an actual energetic discharge in the hands and the feet than most therapies have probably seen. And it's enhancing the discharge process. So I think if we measure the galvanic skin response, we could have some pretty amazing data, temperature-wise and so on, that confirms that there's a huge energetic transaction. I also want to do a few measurements between the therapist, practitioner, whether it's myself or Judy or Karen, whoever does it in the fall, to measure the brain waves of the facilitator and the client at the same time. Requires two sets of instruments, but I really want to see what's happening there because somehow the therapist's mind and the client's minds are compensating in some fashion. And I think it would be really interesting. I don't know if anybody's ever done that, but to see how the therapist, I don't think they expected the therapist's physiology to be reacting directly to the client's physiology. And I think that's just going to enter a whole new realm of interest from the medical profession. So we're going to go back to research in the fall. I'm shooting for October. I may do a talk at the Theosophical Society. They just sent me a request that I do another talk there. That'd be our third YouTube video. for the Theosophical Society. The 290 minutes, we have now 5 videos. I did put the Migraine Ease video up. So remind your clients of migraines that it is available. I might have freaked them out by the 5-minute disclaimers at the front. But, you know, I think medically we just have to be very careful. But I didn't get any flack from it, negative flack. So I may actually try then to do a flashback ease video, which could bring the world down upon us. But I think if there's a way to say, no, I'm not here to change your history. I'm just here to talk to you about how your body's stored some of the imagery and history and some techniques that might ease your ability to work with that and process that. So I think I have a Milton Ericksonian conditional language mastered well enough to talk to them about making, without making false claims that we're going to fix your trauma, heal your memories. Although the side effect is that a lot of stuff will go away. A lot of the trances can stop if they send those corrective signals. So yes, as to the complexity of your case, Lawrence, with vets, you know, I prefer they not be overly medicated with anything. I often suggest, I don't know how long it takes. If a person's been using marijuana for a long time, I don't even know how long it would take. So I believe marijuana's cannabis is one of the things that's fat soluble, I think, and can stay in the body. Or maybe it was LSD, I know, is, so that you can start losing weight in your 60s and 70s and have your flashbacks from the 60s. You know, you can go back to Woodstock pretty quickly when you're losing weight, apparently. So some people had some adventures about that. But, yeah, I'm not sure. I need to get Mary Gabby online. She tried once. I think she
Lawrence just wrote that it is fat soluble.
Okay.
Marijuana.
Okay. So, yeah, so I think people, it can be stored in the system, and then years later when you're trying to lose weight, you can test positive for marijuana when you stopped smoking it a long time ago. So, urine tox for about a month, yeah, after you stop using it. So that's interesting. But there are teenagers now coming across that have used it. They're like in their 20s, and they've used it since they were 12 or 13 We're already 8 years, 9, 10 years into this daily use, practically. And I'm like, oh my goodness, you know. I have no idea what the impact of that is. I mean, I've seen amotivational kinds of things, so I think it is affecting decision-making. Oh, dude, I don't know, maybe I'll go to college, you know, maybe not, I don't know. They had more traffic light accidents after they legalized marijuana in those states. Yeah, I think the light's green. I don't know. I'm not sure. Let's see. Should we slow down? It's affecting decision making and processing. So it'd be interesting to see how marijuana affects executive functioning in the brain. I think that's one of the things we might want to take a look at eventually. All right. Other questions, folks? Cases? Things that have been coming up for you?
I have a question about Xanax.
Xanax? Uh-huh.
Yeah. How long? I have a new client who has had use the marijuana and Xanax. It's a new client I haven't seen.
How frequently are they using the Xanax?
No. I don't know yet. But if he has used, how long it takes?
If it's just a popping one like once every 2 weeks or something, it's not that big a deal. But if he's used it regularly for a period of time, as I've talked to Mary Gaddy about the Xanax, you'd have to go from a longer acting, I think, to a shorter acting version and kind of wean them off of it. And that can take 3 to 6 months. I've had people, if they just stop using Xanax, they have worse panic attacks than before they ever started. And then they'll increase their PRN, and they'll start popping Xanax. And they get more dependent than they were before, which creates greater anxiety attacks when they're trying to get off it. And now they're in a loop, they're in a spiral. They need professional help to get off of it. If they're on Xan, I generally don't work with people on, or I will not work with a person that's on a regular use of Xanax. It's like the quick, you know, it's not the one that's prescribed professionally. Klonopin is prescribed professionally because it's a longer acting kind of thing and not the quick, short, fast dosage kind of thing. But
so it's better not to even try the reframing?
It depends. You have to ask how often he's using it. If he's using Xanax on a daily, regular basis, I would not even, I'd say it's a waste of his money right now. Mm-hmm. I had the same thing happen with a guy who's this professional meditator and referred to me by, I don't know if it's Saima or Amaji, one of the big, you know, spiritual leaders of our decade or century. And they were referring this guy who was having a lot of trouble writing, going back to his poetry. And then I found that he had gotten addicted to painkillers and benzodiazepines. He got off the painkillers, but he was still using the benzodiazepines. And I said, you know, I'd be glad to help, because she was having, she had a sponsor, somebody who's willing to pay to send him for therapy. But I said, I'm not going to take anyone's money when he's still on the benzodiazepines, because it's kind of absurd. I said, you need to detox off the benzos, because whatever memories you have, I can't get to them if they're buried underneath a layer of benzodiazepines. I said, we're not going to get accurate reframing. And then they said, okay, we'll do that. Then when he got off the benzos, I think he felt a lot better, and maybe his writing came back. So the benzos not only repressed his memories, they repressed his creativity, and the benzos probably were the problem and affected his ability to creatively visualize and meditate. So I think when he got off the benzos, a lot of things corrected themselves. But he was, it's a drug addiction issue at that point. So if they're on marijuana and or benzodiazepines, you're going to have to take a look at that and see how often they're using. The marijuana, they can do some reframing, but you're going to have to keep an eye on that and see if the memories that you reframe come back weeks later, or if it's still there, if it still holds a charge. You can always test. Thanks, Gail. You got to go? Okay. Yes, and Gail, you know, you got my information, right? So we're good for Sarnia? Okay. Anyway, the rest of you. So does that help, Erica, a little bit, kind of?
Yeah.
You may want to talk to Mary Gaddy. I think she's listed on the website. There's a phone number to reach Mary. So any consultations, I'm sure she'd be glad to talk with any of you about clients that are on benzodiazepines. Mm-hmm. She's our co-head of our research committee and can answer questions about how benzos affect memory. Dr. Jim Kowal in Naperville, who did our research, is also a resource. Mm-hmm. He'll tell you what the brain waves are that or and how they're impacted.
So there is a danger that the memory can be recovered but not be able to replace?
Correct. You can access it. You can get right down to T-1. And when they move the color through the body to anchor it, it goes around the site. It doesn't. That's my metaphor for it. Seems like it goes around it and doesn't create the change. Doesn't put in the correction.
That could re-traumatize a patient?
Correct? Not re-traumatize them, but it's just going to still be where it was. Mm. I mean, it's going to be the same. Mm. I don't think it's brilliant. I think they're numbed out on the Xanax or the Klonopin, whatever the benzo is. So they're numbed out. They're not going to be re-traumatized when they're on the drug. That's why the doctors are giving it to them. So they're not in continuous memory-based trauma. So the Xanax will stop it from being an ongoing, overwhelming pain. But if we can't get to it, it's kind of like you can talk about cleaning the closet. But if you just, you know, dude, I'm popping the Xanax, I'm looking at the closet, you know, but I'm not really going to get in it. Xanax, the benzos keep you outside the closet. You can see it. You can see the memory. You can see what's going on. You get the data. You can see what happened. You can see what you should change about it. But when you go to change it, you're outside the closet. You're not in the trance state. You're not able to get in the affect of the trance state. Apparently what the benzos do is they lock out the affect. So if you're not in the affect of the trance, the key affect, you can't move a correction because you're not in that place right now. You're not at T-1. You know, you can get to it, you can see what it is. It's very frustrating because you can see what it is. And then the next day or a week later, they come back and they repeat the same memory as though you didn't do a thing. So it's kind of taking their money under false pretenses. If we know about this, you know, you don't want to, you know, say, or what I'll say, here's the risk. I explained it to them. I was like, okay, you're on occasional benzos. If you're telling me the truth about that, then the reframing may hold. If, however, you're on other drugs or medications and it comes back and the memory has not been released, and if your energy sensitive, which I think you are, and you're linked to the body, you can tap when it's releasing. And if nothing happens, mm-hmm. you're like, I didn't feel much of a change when you ran the color, so I didn't feel anything. That's not describing any tingling in his hands or feet. Doesn't look like it's releasing. And if the metaphor is kind of either still there or maybe diminished, or I'm not sure I feel it as much, I don't know what that looks like exactly. But those are things I would check for. Usually I'm pretty good with that. I'm like, is it releasing? I'm like, no, this is not doing any. I can't feel anything. I can't feel the body. Can't feel the memory. I can't feel the charge. So you know, it's been a long time since I even attempted to do HMR on anybody that's a serious benzo issue. So they haven't been, I haven't come across that in a while. Mm-hmm. I talk about that in my lectures at Miraval. So people, I think people who have benzo use, I don't think they sign up. I think those that are using Klonopin and Xanax, I'm like, and benzodiazepines block access to memory. It's the one drug that interferes. So I think I'm kind of warning them off at time. But I stay pretty busy, pretty booked up most of the time with that. What's fun lately is that I'm already started this year. I mean, between now and March, I mean, you have one more opening. But people are flying in Sundays. They do two sessions Monday, one on Tuesday, two sessions on Wednesday. If you're going to do intensive work with people, my suggestion is do an initial a presentation or talk one evening or one day. Do two sessions the first day, one session the second day, two sessions the third day, and then ease up and they can leave after that or do one final session if they want or whatever. But the second full day, they need to take a break in the afternoon. Because by the time you've done three successive intense sessions, they need a break. They need a processing time, and they need to relax, or they need to do something. So they'll go up to Mount Lemmon here in Tucson, or go to the Desert Museum, or go hiking in Sabino Canyon. But those that really know the technique and are doing well, when they hit the end of that third actual session, one on Monday morning, one on Monday afternoon, one on Tuesday morning, Tuesday afternoon, if we attempted to do another full session, like four back-to-back like that, they're fried. Even those, especially those that are very intuitive and energetically sensitive, they're processing a lot of data in a session. And they're doing, you know, each session increases the number of memories by a couple. So it goes from 5 to 7. By the third session, you could be 8 or 9 memories. So it's in our third session. And then they were like, I was kind of like out of it a little bit after the third session. I needed to take the after. So they misscheduled me. I had something in Miraval. So I'm like, that worked out perfectly. And then we just did kind of a little processing session on Tuesday night. But I'm pretty much going to stick to two sessions the first day, one the second day, two the third day, and then they can leave or go back or do whatever they need to do. Some people try to stay longer, but you know, by the time you do that many memories in a short amount of time, they kind of need a break. So if you're going to do it in phases and work with a client over time intensively, have them come in and work with you and do like an introductory kind of touch base, get connected. Maybe I scan them the first night and see what's going on. So you just get some rest because you flew in today. A lot of people are flying in on Saturday, taking the day off, and then they start with me Sunday evening. And they start with a session on Sunday evening, then do two on Monday, one on Tuesday, two on Wednesday, and they fly out Thursday. That's a nice intensive process for people that hear about your work and they want to fly in and do intensive work with you. That works really, really well. And then usually they're hour and a half sessions. Routinely. Sometimes you go a little over. I do by the hour. So I just build them for the total hours at the end of the session, end of the sequencing. So if somebody wants to turn you into their little personal, I also give a massage envy massage cards. I have massage envy every month. So when I have extra cards, I'll say, if you need a massage, you can go over to massage envy. These are the people that do cranial sacral therapy. There's one that's very good, Hawaiian. So I'll have them do cranial or a combination of cranial and massage. Something like that and do a little body work. So we have our own little mini treatment center set up here in Tucson now, so it works nicely. That works pretty well. So that's another way to do it intensively also with folks. And so anyway, other questions, cases? You all survived, Holly. Welcome to 2020, yay, here we are.
I have a question.
Karen, yes?
Yes. So talking about memories and emotions, I'm currently at a resort in central Vietnam, and at the spa, they have their own intake form, and it doesn't include medications. And so the specific client that I'm thinking of, and then also she had booked a session with me for something else. One of my energy healing modalities, Jinsen Jitsu. Uh-huh. But then I always do a little consultation. And in that conversation, it came up that the HMR would be a more appropriate modality to use. And so we went into that. But as we were having the conversation going through the process. She had stated at one point that she doesn't feel emotions. That was one of her things. She doesn't feel emotions. So other than the question of whether or not she's on medications, mm-hmm. what other questions might you probe to go into? And I'll also add before you respond, towards the end, her head became quite heavy. She started to sort of really droop and go into some, but I don't actually even think that she realized that was happening. It was interesting because her head was drooping. But we did a couple of memories and then I did some cranial with her at the end. But I was just curious about the inability that she said that she to feel emotions. And when there was a point where she was laughing at something and I said, well, see, you can feel emotions. There's that joy, there's laughter. So tapping into some of the others, just curious about what might be suppressing those emotions.
Sure.
So they would talk about lots of childhood trauma. She didn't, there were some things withheld. Yeah.
Okay. Is she the child of an alcoholic, do you know?
No, see, but the one thing is that I told her that we could do this process via distance online. So mm-hmm. she was very interested in continuing. So whether or not she does, then I could go into those types of other mm-hmm. questions that I would have asked in my own setting, I suppose. Yeah.
Okay. Well, the first thing is when they say they don't feel emotions, that suggests an early block of some sort. So number one is when you were looking at her, does she have blank affect? Does she reveal her feelings in her face?
Sorry, there's a tour group going by. She's able to smile. She does smile at you, but other than that, it's pretty stoic.
Okay. So usually the question you would ask, she already gave you the question. Well, if you were to reframe it as an HMR possibility, what would the question be? Do you know what the question would be? Sometimes what I say is, how young are you? How young in your history are you when it's not safe to do emotions anymore in your family?
Okay.
How young are you when it's not safe to feel? Was it safe? And start that discussion. Was it safe to be emotional in your family? Was your mother a very emotional person? Were they very expressive? Were they the children of alcoholics? Because if we had parents that were children, my father was Asperger's. He's like, I don't know if he ever looked up. So he didn't make eye contact. So there's no emotional transfer. There's no expression of feeling. So as a little child, I was kind of blank, wide-eyed and sort of blank, staring.
Mm.
Oh, he's shy. He's quiet. Yeah, well, it's like, okay, if you don't show feelings or emotions. My mother was a person whose face, she'd walk into a room and children start smiling. Like, oh, happy, compassionate lady, okay. So thank God I had the other side, so, we could do both. But if they don't have any affect, like I mentioned a few sessions ago, supervision sessions, a girl that came in and had complete blank affect, no eye contact, wouldn't make any eye contact throughout the introduction, and then eventually shared that she had had a serious motorcycle accident, had brain damage, and had psychotic episodes after that where she's hallucinating, and so she was terrified of even connecting with people at that point without being re-traumatized. And so she was having no affect, no feeling connections. That's the absolute extreme into psychosis, some kind of brain damage, mental illness. But normally if they just say, I don't feel things, I don't feel emotions, you can also ask, do you have any memories of your childhood? Do you remember very much from your childhood? And they'll often say, no, I really don't think I remember too much. Or if they say, oh, I think it was just kind of uneventful. Sometimes the parents, did they give hugs and say, I love you? The question that I do to determine the affect of the parents is, did they give hugs and say, I love you? Oh, we didn't do that. They were very kind of traditional parents. They're very proper. You knew you were loved. They'll say, we knew we were loved, but they never really said anything about that. Just kind of knew from their actions that we were loved. Mm-hmm. So start fishing for the source of the affect. If they have feelings and they're expressive, then the parents are expressive. If they have no affect and they're shut down, either the parents or somebody else shut down their ability to have feelings. And you want to just find out where that is in the history. It sounds like level two, repression of emotions from one or both parents, that they ask if the parents fought a lot. Did they fight a lot? Because if the parents fought a lot, then they'll say, oh, yeah, no, they fought all the time. And like, I just couldn't deal with that. So then you ask, how young are you when you turn down your emotional pain perceptions? Because when they turn down, when they say that, and they turn down emotional pain perceptions, what else can you expect? They may have trouble with color. Now, what's interesting is watch this pattern. I don't know if you ever mentioned this. Is if they have trouble with color and emotions and they're saying, I don't do feelings, guess what they do for a career? They'll be artists. They'll be graphic designers. They're running around looking everywhere they possibly can for colors. You know, they'll be painters. They'll do something to do with color and design. And you're like, you can see that they're desperately looking for some way to integrate color into their lives. And like, it's coming from a complete emotional color deprivation. They're seeking that out in their career options. And so I see that quite a lot. It's fascinating. Like, yeah, if you have a chance to do anything with color, oh yeah, well, I'm a graphic designer. Oh yeah, well, I'm an architect and an interior designer. I do a lot with colors. I said, I can see why, because you have no color, your color perception was shut out at a pretty young age. Sometimes when you ask, how young are you when it wasn't safe to have feelings in your family, they'll give you the age. Oh, it was 10. Mom and dad thought so much. I said enough of this. I'm not dealing with these crazy people. I'm not going to be hurt by them anymore. And the day the inner child turned down color perception, that's when she numbed out. Now, sometimes they don't remember doing that, and there was an event of rape or abuse of them, which they may or may not remember. That could be the source of the emotional numbing. So if you ask, how young are you when you just go numb? Sometimes if you just do like a, you know, oh, I hear the number 10. Can you see where you are and then get ready for a few surprises? Because they might find a memory where something really awful happened and they felt ashamed. If there's a lot of shame, I dealt with somebody this week. I think there was a lot of shame coming out. And so they didn't really want to go into feelings very much. You could see that there was a part of them that, how old are you? Well, I kind of get an impression of an age, but I can tell she's fighting me. She doesn't want to disclose her age. Why is that? It feels like she's really ashamed of something, or embarrassed. And we couldn't get the memory, no matter what we said. I said, let her know, it's not her fault. She was 9. And I said, we don't know right from wrong until 7 or 8. And I said, so even at 9, it's not really her fault. She didn't really buy into it, the 9-year-old. The 9-year-old still would not tell us what that memory was. She says, there's a memory, and it has to do with shame. I said, was she willing just to go with you to your safe place? And she said, yes. She's willing to go to the safe place, but she's not ready to talk about whatever happened at 9. I said, that's fine. Once she's safe in the safe place, tell her. After she's relaxed, it wasn't her fault, and you love her, and she can talk to you about it when she's in the safe place. But she said, yeah, she'll go to the safe place, but she doesn't want to talk about the shame thing, whatever it was. I said, I don't need to know the shame thing, but she's lovable and it's not her fault. And you barely know right from wrong at 9. So maybe somebody tricked you or made you think it was your fault or that you were bad. So these are all resistance things that could cause a block to emotional access, why they wouldn't feel. If there's a lot of shame, a lot of fear, they don't want to do feelings like that. If they think it's all their fault, they won't talk about the feelings at all. The part won't talk about feelings if they think it's all their fault. And so a lot of times they won't disclose very much if they feel really ashamed about something. And sometimes you kind of feel that, or you get a little intuitive hit on that, but it's about shame. You know, you're only 6 years old, and talk about the little shame education, you know. But we don't know right from wrong until 7 or 8. So if somebody told you it was your fault, or you thought it was your fault, or you did something bad, then usually that came from outside of us first, and it's not your fault. You're only 6, 7, or 8 years old, and we don't really know right from wrong. So we're not going to blame you. We just want to make you safe. And if we need to heal something, we can, but it's hard to forgive and heal it if we don't know what it is. Can you see if your 9-year-old would be willing to tell us what that was? So these are all things that you could do technically to kind of identify and see if there's a block to that. Reinforce safety. Say, you know, really it's safe to have emotions or feelings. You're the adult. You have all the missing colors. Let her know that you'd like to help her. The adult you does. Every adult you work with has connection to white light. So they do have connection to all the feelings and all the colors. But as to why she would say, I don't have, what was her phrase? I don't do feelings very much. I don't to her very much?
That she doesn't express them. Or she doesn't, well, she doesn't have the, so really the, she doesn't feel she has the ability to express them. But as you were speaking earlier about the parental situation, she did, so the first memory was of her as a five-year-old and at the whole family at the kitchen table, and the father became really angry with the mother, overturned the table. And then with her younger sister, who would have been two at the time. So she was taking on that protector role, which she commented on was a problem she has, that she's always taking on this protector role. But so we had a conversation around that in terms of, you know, luckily her sister had her to help, that sort of thing. But, and it
did you,
sounds
were you
like
able, were you able to reframe that with her, that scene?
Yes, yes. Okay. And then when we went into something later,
I didn't mean to interrupt you, but that's
okay.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say that when we went into a later situation of 12, that reframing also sort of applied in that situation in terms of being having a supportive family and being able to go to school and have, you know, lunches made and that sort of thing. But it also, she mentioned that her children didn't feel safe in the family environment, and that her own children didn't feel safe. And she did not elaborate. We didn't have the time to go into that. So that would be perhaps
she
something.
She probably married her father, ongoing. Married her mother.
Yes, that's what I was, yeah.
So you did the reparenting with her, or a variation of that? Did you bring in healthy parents that didn't fight, or dad didn't do that day? Or
I'm trying.
Remember if
I
it was a level
remember.
One or a level two. So your option would be, some people will say, oh, I just want dad to not do that day. That's fine. Let's have dad be nice, not overturn the table, not go psycho, and then we can all be safe. So a couple of things happened that we want you to hear. When dad did that, and she became the protector, she's the oldest child?
Yes.
Yeah. So she became the hero protector of her younger siblings, sibling. When she did that, that's emotional incest. That's a role reversal. So at that point, she becomes the adult, says, I need to numb out to deal with this. And she pushed her feelings aside. So ultimately, you could do almost a double reframe on that. One is, I need to have healthy parents and not have to become a parent and numb out. And the second is, if I did have healthy parents, it would be okay for me to be a little girl and keep having my feelings and grow up and have emotions and not have to worry about rescuing everybody else in life, because that's what should
happen. Okay. Yeah.
So you could do a double reframe kind of thing. One would be like, let's have dad not do that. Now, that's a great point. When they go to do it, a lot of clients in their very first memory like that, they were introducing reparenting. Like, okay, if we could change that. Do we need a new dad? Oh, yeah, that would be great. Let's do that. And they'll just say, absolutely. Let's bring in a new dad. Well, I feel bad about it. Now, what do you do? Remember this. What do you do if they say, oh, I feel guilty about firing my dad? And I'm like, okay, let me make a little, HMR is a light trance state. So this is where you do a pause and you do a little educational explanation. We're not really going to do anything to your father. Your father, we're grateful. You wouldn't be who you are today without the genetics. I'm grateful you're perfectly who you're meant to be. And that's how you chose your parents, whatever, if they can handle that one. But the reality is, the dad and the mom that you're looking at, I just lost my train of thought for a second. The dad and mom that you're looking at, let me rephrase this differently. Rather than saying firing dad, I said, do you have children? Obviously she has children. Mm-hmm. In raising your children, could you use your father and mother as the role models for raising your children? Oh, no. I did the opposite of them. I made sure that I was sober and kind and took care. I said, exactly. So in your subconscious, you fired your dad a long time ago. So I'm just saying you never did that for yourself. So the reparenting exercise is simply anchoring into your subconscious something you already did for yourself decades ago. You said, oh, I can't raise children like that. Oh, my God. Would you turn a table over at dinner with your children there and knock all the food on the floor and scare the crap out of them? No, of course not. I would never do that. Exactly. So you did the opposite. But what you've never done is gone in and brought in a healthy dad for your inner children. So we're not going to fire your father exactly. We're going to fire the subconscious software program that we call Dad and say, can we use Dad or do we bring in a new software program? Oh no, I brought in a new one a long time ago. I said exactly. So if you could picture what a wonderful nurturing dad would be at that moment. And if you do that with her and she pictures that healthy dad and does that, like a client I just worked with that flew in to work with me, he's using the new dad and mom every day. You know, he's like picturing that, fleshing it out, making it real. And you do it 52 times and you have in your subconscious the upgraded dad version or the new software program. So in that software program, it's always safe to have your emotions and to express your emotions safely and freely. So obviously, yeah, you're dealing with some level two and level one kinds of patterns, and it's happened to her quite a lot. But that's a really, really good example of like, oh, I it's not safe to feel. Well, that's probably right. The minute they say that, that's not a one-time thing. Usually that's a level two distortion. And if parents didn't, mom and dad, you can ask, did mom and dad do feelings? That will introduce the reparenting question. Do we need to bring in a new dad? Oh, I don't want to hurt. I can't hurt my parents. No, we're not going to change your parents. That's already a done deal. Nope. Your parents are who they were. You are who you are. What we're asking is, can you use that software program to raise your kids and grandkids? Or did you bring in a different program? Oh, no, I fired that a long time ago. Exactly. I said you brought in a new program. You did the opposite of your dad, or you dramatically upgraded it. So you've already done that. So now let's just anchor it for you. So if you can bring in the kind of mom and dad you wanted for your kids, if we could bring that to your inner child, how would she be different? Oh, it would be safe to have feelings. So you can actually, in the software, and in level three, I think I talked about belief level, end of level two, level three, I talked about belief system. What's the negative message you got from dad turning the table over? If you want to go into belief systems, you could go into belief system about that. What's the negative message that, oh, it's not safe to have feelings in this family. You'll get a table knocked over on you if you get angry or sad. He attacked mom. Okay, so it's not safe for people to have feelings. What's the personal message? Oh, I can't show feelings or I'm going to get hurt or violated. Okay, so so the negative message for the family, the negative personal message for you, what's the corrective message? Oh, that it is safe now for me to have feelings and emotions. Okay. If it's safe for you to have feelings, what color frame do you put around that? That it's, oh, the rainbow, all the colors. It's safe to have all the emotions. Okay, so let's move rainbow through your body for the next few days, or pink. It might be pink, that it's safe to have feelings, to have the feminine heart, and run the pink through your body for the next few days. So you can actually start working. Eventually, you can get around to working with the belief system and anchoring in a corrective belief. So when you move pink through your body, you're affirming every day, it's safe for me to have emotions. It's safe for me to have feelings. It's safe for me to experience these things. Okay? Is that helpful? Does that kind of...
It's very helpful. The other thing that came up with her, so that initial five-year-old memory, that had it was about 30 centimeters long of a bronze arrow coming like through the psoas into the hip flexor. So obviously larger than the body.
On her right side or her left side?
On the right side.
On her dad's side. Okay.
Yeah, and she didn't want to let go of it. So when we talked about taking it out, she wanted to hold, and she like made this, you know, fist, like she was holding it. And I said, well, you know, I had to sort of encourage her a couple of times about the fact that it's not really serving her anymore, whether she could bring in, and she was able to bring in blue. And interestingly enough, when we went to the cranial, there was something that came in on the left hip. And so we did a reframing there as well. And she also brought in blue, which I brought up to her attention later, because I recalled that she had brought in like a deeper blue on the right and then a blue on the left side as well. So I was curious about how often do you have people wanting to hold on to their icon of pain or suffering or whatever it is. She did say she wanted to use it as like a memory of, you know, what she's been through and what she's been able to survive, I suppose.
Okay. That's interesting, you know, that you'd want to hold on to it as a
souvenir.
A positive metaphor as kind of it's more than a souvenir. There's something else going on with that.
It was sort of like if she described it as a sense of power, strength that she's been able to come through this, like in sort of that, you know, that rational, conscious mind of, mm-hmm. well, I'm now an adult, I'm, you know, in control of my life, and this is like the arrow that proves that or something.
But that's different from letting it stab into your psoas muscle on your
exactly,
right.
Yeah.
So I'd say, I don't mind you keeping it, but let's put it outside of you in a special place where it's a protective device. Use it. I use arrows. I use all kinds of things, resources outside of me. But understand, she might have a little confusion. At the time the trauma occurred, she felt it inside her body. So she stored the arrow inside the hard drive of the computer, which is somatically her right psoas area. So she thinks, in a way, it's a little delusional kind of a thing that we think we're holding on to. And we do that a lot. We think we're holding on to the memory, but you're holding on to an axe or an arrow or something. And she wonders why this pain in her psoas. So it's like, okay, to store it, but you might want to put it in a spiritual place or put it on the shelf in your safe place as a reminder, protector or something. Let's get it outside your body and put something nice and healing inside your physical body. I think that might just be a mechanical error that she's not realizing that all of the traumas we ever froze, we froze inside the computer. But if you froze, you know, I want to have the memory of September the 11th inside my, no, you don't want to keep replaying that. You want to keep have the Twin Towers coming down in your body every day. This is not going to go well for your metabolism or your physiology. You know, it literally quantum wise, it creates the arrow, maintains the arrow. So an arrow that is used from outside of you to protect you. Or you might have said, is there anybody you want to throw the arrow at or give it back to? And I got a bunch of clients that would say, oh yeah, I know exactly where that goes. You know, not dad, but maybe his behaviors. If she threw the arrow or used it, is this about, and my guess is she's holding on to the arrow because there may be, and maybe about her husband, we talked about there being a marriage. She might be holding on to the arrow because she's like, I'm going to need this again because my dad is still showing up for his return. And like, I might need this thing again, you know? Yeah. So then you move into the whole, did she marry her father, like you said?
Yeah.
And she's like, yeah, she's, her children don't feel safe. Well, why do her children not feel safe? She seems like a pretty safe person, but there must be she's attracted some kind of violence into her history. So that's quite interesting. Sometimes the only I would be very suspicious of them. They say they're holding on to the negative metaphor. You either want it transferred into a positive metaphor or check and see. It's a little different. I'm just winging it here because that's an unusual situation. But I think you'd have to say, is this a positive arrow now? Or is it still causing you pain? Because then if you say I'm holding on to the pain metaphor, that would be interesting. Yes, Karen?
I had that come up with just one client. It was fairly recent. She was a very strong person and a physician and very intelligent. And she said, I have to remove that rod and I have to hold it and keep it. And all the little me's are in my safe place, but they've each got one. And she said, I will deal with it later, but now I have control of it.
Nice.
So it was more a control thing. And eventually she said, we don't have those anymore. We don't need those anymore. But we had some more memories we had to process in subsequent sessions before the little girls were ready
before
to
the rod, yeah,
the
convert
rod,
it over.
Yeah, the rod. Okay. And the other thing for Karen that I thought about, since it was a meal and a table, expect some dietary problems and maybe even some allergies, as you've told us before. If we're eating macaroni and cheese
when the table turns over.
Yep.
What was in her stomach that day? What was the meal at the table? That'd be worth asking about for her physiology. If she has digestive problems or what's in your body when the bad thing happens, especially the dinner today.
Yeah.
What Karen said is true. Makes sense. It's about control and power. And I think it's hinting. My gut says it's hinting at that there's another piece to this, that the arrow might be needed as an aggressive issue.
Oh, for sure.
From somebody else. Her husband is drunk or gone a little wacko on us and I'm going to need it again. So she's not safe yet and she's trying to use the original metaphor.
Yeah.
It's kind of true. And what Karen said is true. I think if you reframe the memories and she gets away from the dad and away from the abusive memories of a husband or ex-husband, maybe now, you know, that she won't need the arrow that way. Although arrow's a symbol of power. I just don't think, I said, but the problem is, you know, you're turning it on yourself and holding it in your body and stabbing your soul as. So can we put it outside? Can we hold it outside of us and give all the children an arrow? Let them protect them from aggressive men that would hurt us and use that as a boundary protection? That would be a cool thing to do. Yeah, what color? Golden arrow color. Let's just, so whenever you need to feel safe, run your golden arrow color through your body and you have choices.
No, I like that. I wasn't sure that we could keep that icon. So that's really helpful to know that that's an option as long as we've taken it out of the safe space, out of the body, and turn it into some sort of strength that you can use.
But yeah, I think the subconscious is saying, I'm still having the experience. Yeah, I'm still trapped in a similar situation, and the arrow is still here, and it's still causing me pain, which is telling me as we're listening, is still telling you and I that there's still an unfinished scene, and she's still paying the price for the lack of reframing of that violent event.
Honestly, I think it's just, we've just sort of begun to scratch the surface a bit.
Yeah, and it's the thing just, about the husband or the current relationship,
like,
not safe, something.
And she's, when I mentioned the HMR, she said her sister had done something, had done it. So I think some people may have, I'm not sure if it's exactly HMR, it might be EMDR or whatever, but a similar process in France.
Oh, so you know, the other thing about the arrow stabbing is guilt, is feeling guilt about not. Okay. And when she said, oh, my children were not safe too, then it comes to mind that she's holding on to it. Because part of it is like, well, you know, I should be punished because I created the same thing for my kids and my kids were not safe and I didn't protect them. When that's going on, at that point, she's going to hold on to the arrow because she still is in an unresolved trauma scene with her children not safe. When her children weren't safe and she saw that, she was re-traumatized as the 6-7-year-old, whatever, at the dinner table. She was also re-traumatized by that. So it would be indicating that there's an unfinished memory or group of memories, like you said, that still need to be addressed. And it could be guilt related, because when she said that, I'm like, oh, she's going to hold on to this, or the pain is going to still be there because it's now linked to the fact that she feels like she somehow contributed to the re-perpetration of her children when they were growing up, that they weren't safe. And I see that a lot with parents. So that does happen.
Okay. Thank you. Very helpful. Thank you.
Other question, Karen, Mr. Bill? Yeah. Thanks, Karen. That was great too. Mr. Bill?
Yeah, I have a question, kind of a general about, I think you had talked about ADHD, and I've been looking through my notes to try to find it. I've got a new potential client that I've had conversation with over the phone, a consultation, and she talks fast. She bounces around to different, you know, what kind of remedies and approaches do you have for working with people who are, you know, have that kind of focus that bounces all over?
Well, you know, I had my younger sister had a child that was showing a lot of ADD symptoms. She tried everything natural and healing alternatives and everything imaginable, and then put him on Ritalin and he made straight A's and he was fine. So, you know, the point is the reticular activating system in the brain is not getting data fast enough. So with the true ADD or ADHD stuff, they're hyperactive. Now, what I did say probably in my notes is that I talked with Dr. Mariko Tanaka years ago. A certain amount of hyperactivity when they're jumping around like that is actually hypervigilance from a violent childhood. So they're hyperactive, hypervigilant, hypersensitive. So they're jumping all over the place and they're really panicked. It's like hypervigilant, PTSD, waiting for something to happen. So check to see if the childhood context was safe or if there was violence, unpredictability. Because some of the hyperactivity and jumping around could be lack of safety and not really hyperactivity. It could be hypervigilance. So if you reduce that, then there. Some childhood depression, the quote is, and this is from Don Hoppe in Baton Rouge, actually. Some childhood depression manifests as hyperactivity in children. They're depressed, they're sad, they're overwhelmed, and so they're jumping all over the place because they're like, oh my God, when's the bad thing gonna happen next? So you wanna check for that. The other piece, however, is that, you know, they've come up with techniques and things. I don't know exactly what Susan McCrossan is doing. It'd be interesting to have her, which I need to talk with her, maybe have more information about what they do for ADD and ADHD and processing memories. One thing they do inpatient is if they give them something in their hands to occupy them, like they'll give inpatient, they'll give them Play-Doh or something. If the hand starts somehow when the one part of the mind goes into sensory activation, like the child part is active and calmed down, then the adult mind goes linear and they can respond and answer questions. So that's one technique they've done that has proven effective for people. So apart from that, I had a client I worked on not so long, was kind of, I don't know if she was medicated or just outgrown a lot of it. She was doing pretty well, but I did have to keep bringing her focus back to the primary memory. Mm-hmm. So I had to keep returning her to the primary focus. And so I'd say, let's go back to what we were talking about in the memory. She would kind of drift and sort of go and spin off into a little tangent and kind of pull it back and say, okay, now about that. Or, you know, talk about maybe reframe a sub-memory and then go back. But I'd have to remember and bring her back to the originating memory, or she'd spin off into something else and not reframe. And you have to remind them, let's put a frame around it. Let's put a color. Let's run the color through your body. So you're doing more work with that person because they're kind of jumping. Mm-hmm. And they're not staying linear. They're not staying focused. And HMR to reframe at some level needs to stay pretty linear. Mm-hmm. But the color is non-linear. It speaks to the whole system. But to get to the color, you got to keep them focused for a little while to get to the solution mechanism. So that's the only thing. But you know, the ADD piece has not been my specialty. I've struggled with that sometimes too.
I had one who was similar, and we did an enhanced safe scene, and we talked about the parts of you that might need to do something else while we work. Mm-hmm. And there was a part that needed to run around the house the whole time we were working in the house, in the conference mm-hmm. room. And that
worked. And that worked? That helped?
That seemed to help, yeah.
That's a possibility. If you can find the part that is kind of ADD-ish or hyperactive or anxious, what would part like to do?
Well, also, how young might you be when you didn't find a safe place to sit and relax? When you felt like you needed to be doing things quickly.
That's interesting. That could raise a whole separate question about the safety being tied to movement or being still or some kind of a trauma, physical violence in the household. You'll have to look and see what the source of that would be. Why is she having to run around? What would help her so she wouldn't need to run around? It's okay if you do, you know, but a lot of children running around, they're going to be beaten or traumatized from running around the house and creating chaos. It's going to be the other way around. But it's very interesting that you would have to run around to feel safe.
Right. What is that you say, about? How young might you be when you had to run around? You know, daddy strangling mama and I just ran for help or whatever.
Right. And that could be memory based, so that they're actually pointing out a memory. It's possible that some ADD, hyperactivity, hypermobility would be tied to fleeing from a crisis event. You need to investigate that and check those possibilities. I just haven't seen a pattern with the ADD person to confirm anything like that yet consistently. But I'm open to it. Maybe, like you said, the client, you need to run around and it worked. Let her run around and take all the time you need to do that. I can't say too much more about that. A lot of times it is Adderall or Ritalin and they calm down and focus. I can't tell when clients are ADD if they're on Adderall or Ritalin. They'll process normally. I can tell when they're not on any medication. Oh, we don't do meds. We refuse to take meds. But two of our children are on meds now because they were diagnosed ADD by my husband. He doesn't want to take meds, and he's still pretty out there. And he doesn't want to do this technique. He can't focus.
Hey, Brent, this is Jeanette. Uh-huh. I don't do HMR with people, but for those of you who don't know, but I will tell you that I tutor several ADD kids and mm-hmm. I listen for cues. And mm-hmm. a trauma that they all have is related to how the family's reacting about their ADD. You can see it in them. They have a reoccurring trauma that mom and dad or teachers or somebody around them is going to get reactive to them if they don't behave a certain way. So they're always afraid of behaving. And when I tutor them, like if they start to slip into the behavior that is that their parents are fearful about or the teachers are fearful about, the response I'll often get from them is, oh, I'm about to get in trouble. And I can tell they have some of the triggers that you talk about, that they have this trauma around everybody else's reaction to their ADD.
Well, that's a separate piece. Now they have PTSD from the ADD.
Right.
But we don't know. But even if we try to reframe that, if they're ADD, we may have trouble reframing the memory of the ADD.
Right. Right. So the only thing
I don't know what to say about that, but you're right. It is a trauma having the condition. Once they're on Ritalin, we can actually, if I can reframe it, then I say, well, if you can go back and as a child picture not having ADD, can you picture that? Well, yeah, I can do that.
Right. The only thing I can do that helps them usually, and this is like a little piece of HMR, it's the safe scene thing. And the safe scene thing is nobody's here but you and I. Let's picture a place where only you and I are, and I'm not upset about your ADD. I am not concerned. I'm not worried. Let's picture what a place would look like where just the two of us are, and we don't have to worry if you lose your focus and you don't pay attention. I usually say, let's pick a word that I can say to you that will help to focus you back. And that's just because ADDs, you know, if there's something they can focus on, then they evidently snap out of whatever this mental cycle is. But I try to create just a safe place that only for the two of us, because if anybody else can be in their safe place, then they seem to get into this pattern of fear that they're going to start reacting. And that fear gets in the way of us being able to work at all. It actually escalates the ADD.
Scott,
I don't know if that makes any sense.
Yeah, it does. Scott, are you still with us?
Yes, and I've actually been waiting to make a comment, but did you have a question or?
Yeah, I wanted you to make a comment because I figured with the breathing and some things that you do, you'd have some observations about things that you might have been able to, because you got some pretty acute care people that you worked with. I'm sure you worked with some ADD kids and so on. And what you noticed that might be helpful.
So just the last year, I had a couple of adult female clients who are both drug addicts with extreme trauma, extreme neglect, extreme abuse. And I always start off the therapy of in session one or session two with circular breathing that I explained a couple months ago here on this. And that circular breathing, once they start doing it, within a week or two, their system has become much more balanced. They can manage any emotions much better because they have released the excess stress, the excess fear, the excess energy, whatever it might be. Mm-hmm. And so two particular clients that I'm thinking of, both of them had ADHD so strong that they couldn't focus breathing for more than like a minute, and then their brain would start getting scrambled. But both of them had very severe trauma and panic attacks, and so we had to find a way to get the average anxiety and the general stress level down to a manageable level in order to do their severe traumas without getting panic attacks. And so with both of them, I tried different spiritual rhythmic music, either without words or chanting with very soft words that was rhythmic. One of them took the Buddhist type of chanting, and the other one loved either guided kind of things or subtle music. And within a few sessions, they had completely wiped out the ADHD, were completely calm, could focus for 30 minutes, for 40 minutes, whatever. So the excess stress that was in their system was overloading the system to the point that it must have been canceling out the ability to go into the parasympathetic mode, and the system was locked in the sympathetic mode. And so by allowing the conscious mind to lock on to the music or the chanting, they could do the breathing without the interference. So they kind of split their focus, and it didn't take long. And both of them were really, really extremely active and overwhelmed by the ADHD.
Okay. So there, most of their ADHD, in your view, kind of subsided or resolved, or what was diagnosed as, and by the use of the chanting and the breathing.
Yes, although we kept the chanting and breathing at a lower level, just enough that part of the mind could focus on it while they practiced breathing, and within a few sessions, the breathing alone had completely calmed the entire system down. But I found that with almost every other type of ailment or issue that might interfere with visualizing or relaxing enough to get to do the traumas and resolve them. So it's just another way to first get the stress level down, and then everything else becomes much easier, because if their stress level is too high, if their stress level averages 8 out of 10, it's much more difficult to do anything. But if you first get the stress level down to a 3, 4, 5, then you can start releasing those traumas that are less activating without overloading their system.
Mm-hmm. Very good. So, so that's an option to keep in mind, folks. And we gave you some resources a couple of weeks ago when Scott was talking, or last month, about connecting with cyclical breathing, kind of a thing. One thing, Scott, I might invite you to do is, we're not doing a retreat this year. For those of you not aware, we're skipping 2020. We couldn't change venue fast enough to be able to pull it off comfortably. So we're moving all the retreats to Tucson next year at the Retreat Center. So we have the Redemptorist Retreat Center reserved for 2021 and 2022. One thing we do on the retreats is different meditation techniques. So I'm sure folks that are here, if you're available, Scott, I'll put you through the retreat for free. If you want to come in and do a presentation, do something with people each day, a little bit on cyclical breathing or something like that, and teach that and what you do. So I think both personally for meditation and for incorporating it with clients, that would be a wonderful resource to do. And maybe you want to offer, if you want me to co-sponsor with you, a training on cyclical breathing for people to come in and do here or elsewhere in the country, to kind of integrate that with HMR. That may be a nice workshop for us to do conjointly or something like that, and how that could be adapted and worked with. So just some things to think about.
Yeah, and that sounds very interesting. I certainly would be interested in it. Are you saying that that the retreat that you're talking about, though, that's the one in 2021, right?
Correct. We're moving to the Redemptorist Center in 2021. We don't have one this year in March, but we're doing March next year and April the following year here in Tucson.
Yeah. So I'm definitely interested in that, and I'll think about the other offer to maybe have a training with that can combine some of the aspects of EMDR with supplementing methods like breathing, like using a relaxation technique to allow better access to memories that aren't quite on the surface, those kind of things. There's a whole combination of support systems that can help facilitate quicker and less activating HMR experiences. So yeah, I'll definitely think about that and get back to you sometime.
Great. I mean, we could even try doing something online if we want to do something sooner. But anyway, think about that, because I could always set something up and we could host you here. I could set something up with the Holiday Inn Express, the hotel here in Tucson where I do my workshops, because we can handle 25 people or something like that for a workshop here. And we could always set that up for you, do something like that. So anyway, keep that in mind for the year, if not certainly for retreat. People, what happens is the core group and a lot of the core practitioners, we come together every year for the retreat. And it will be in March of next year here in Tucson. And that might be something to incorporate or add on, even a day or something, whatever we need to do for a little workshop on that, because I think that would be very helpful. So I think self-care for all of us that are practitioners, meditation, cyclical breathing, breathing in color. What we're doing with HMR is combining color breath work. You know, often I already do that. You know, breathe in for 4 minutes. You're safe seeing color, and we do 16 breaths a minute minimally. Therefore, after 4 minutes, you've done 64 breaths. So basic HMR education is breathe any solution you have in for 3.5 to 4 minutes, and it's certainly anchored in your subconscious. But to do the cyclical breathing, make sure it's extended through the whole system and is permeating the organs and meridians of the body mind would be very, very helpful, I think. So great. Thanks for sharing that piece too. Okay. Any other questions? We're kind of out of time here a little bit here. We already zipped along here. Any other questions? Heather, I see you. Sorry I didn't get back to you. I had really bad bronchitis, and I'm like, you don't need that, and your son didn't need that while you were here.
Yeah, so, you were
here in Tucson, or did you escape back home? Or
he left. Yeah, it's been a whirlwind. I actually wanted to tell you, too, I found out my son and I have metal toxicity. That's what's
going on. Oh, no. Well,
look at that's what's been wrong the whole time.
So what is it called? Magnesite? Is that what we use? There's a that you drink that draws out toxic metals?
I'm taking the Unda drops with a naturopathic practitioner out of Richmond.
Hang on 1 second. Just one second. Y'all keep talking about that, whether you can hear me or not.
Oh, yeah.
Hang on 1 second on that.
Yes, yeah, so I'm taking those drops, but it's been long haul.
What's it called?
They're called Unda, the UNDA drops. UNDA. They're like plant-based drops. So right now we're doing like a liver and kidney detox. And then I guess then after the first 2 months, then we go through the other numbers. There's a whole bunch of numbers as I looked it up, but the practitioner today told me she hasn't even started getting the metal out yet. I thought we had, and we haven't been. So it's going to be a long haul. It's going to take a year to get it completely out, but he's doing much better. My son is having a lot of problems.
Sorry, found it. Hello, I'm back.
Yeah,
so zeolite, y'all familiar with zeolite?
Oh no.
You're a zeolite?
Oh.
Okay. It is Z-E-O-L-I-T-E. Is combined all natural mineral that has been proven to remove the toxins, free radicals, and metals from your body.
Oh, okay.
So you can mix that with water and drink it each day, and it draws out toxic metals and free radicals and other stuff from your body.
That might be better. She's got me on some like year-long regimen with like these drops. I'm like,
well, that can be good, but I think this might be a natural substance that that has been found to work for people. So a detoxifier, take one measured teaspoon once a day for at least 30 days.
Oh, okay. Okay, good. I'm going to do that too then.
Yeah, see what that does.
I wanted to say maybe at some point, I mean, we could also do a retreat up here. I mean, I wouldn't have room for 25 people per se up in my house.
I hear you.
I'm trying to think of how that would work, but there's a farmhouse by the water that has enough space where people could meet, which would be kind of cool to do at some point.
Maybe we'll do a workshop or something up there, or maybe we'll do a healing intensive or something like that.
That'd be cool.
Because we're always looking for new locations for healing intensives and things like that. And since the trainings are online and are going really well, people are signing up from all over the place for trainings. We'll still do the healing intensives for 12 people, and that's quite reasonable for your location. So we can always look at that. You're near Seattle, right? Kind of.
I'm 3 hours north. So it, either you can fly into Seattle and drive up, or fly into Vancouver.
You're almost a Canadian now. So
yeah, it's almost closer. So then I'm only about 40 minutes south of the airport.
So if you're overwhelmed by Trump, you can flee across the border or go stay with Heather or jump across either way. You
come
know.
Here. Come
you're,
to the forest.
You're close to escape, right?
Exactly. I escaped. I missed Tucson a bit, but And then I wanted to ask you about when I should come do my test with you too, because I gotta finish my dictations. I have enough case studies.
Okay. We'll talk about that a little bit later. Anybody have group questions though, things that we need to deal with before we close for today?
I have one question about clients. So I have somebody I've been kind of helping through things, and she's younger, she's in her early 20s. Mm-hmm. But she's been kind of, or I could say they, she's having this issue trying to figure out if she's like a lesbian or not. She was also raped by somebody recently in the last couple of years, and also her mother's husband had done some stuff to her. So I've been trying to reframe some things for her before she makes a total, she's very confused about her sexuality right now. Uh-huh. She's also telling me that she's got like a few different names. It's almost like she was trying to reinvent herself. So she's called herself other names now at this point and has like changed. I don't know if she's legally actually changed her name, but she's got like three different names. And I don't know if that's three different separate personalities. Uh-huh. I'm not really sure yet. So I thought I should bring that up with you, but so far it seems to be going fairly well with her. And I need to sit down and dictate the, recordings, because she's letting me record what I'm doing with her, so I can dictate that. But I've just been kind of trying to help her through that, because I don't know if her confusion is coming from the sexual trauma that she's had when she was younger, because she was fairly young when it started.
Okay. Well, when you have fragmentation, if you have multiple personalities and multiple parts, you are going to find that there will be separate names, separate genders, separate identities. That's over your head, unless you're a certified therapist. That's mm-hmm. beyond your skills level. Mm-hmm. It's challenging to my skills level because I travel too much. You have to be constantly with that person or near them and have a backup therapist if they turn out to be multiple. Sometimes multiples only emerge gradually over time. Yeah, you're afraid that if you find out how many parts they have, they won't be able to do therapy with you. Now, as far as sexuality goes, there are a lot of lesbians that have had a lot of physical sexual abuse from male figures. And some of their push towards the extremes of lesbianism are about the rage and anger at males. And so you don't want to make a decision about your sexual orientation while you still are in active throes of this trauma bias. Mm-hmm. So the goal is resolve the trauma bias, and what's left after the trauma is resolved is who you really are, obviously.
Okay. That's what I tell.
And if it's really early, so it may just be that. It could be that she had a lot of trauma and early trauma starting quite young. Now, if it started young, there is a possibility that she is sort of working with different, what is my identity, and sort of creating separate possibilities for who she could be. Mm-hmm. If it's a little bit over your head, you may have to work with a local therapist or somebody to kind of get grounded with that. Jeannie Bine in Colorado Springs has specialized, you can always consult with her. Has specialized in sexuality issues. She's certified in HMR. Some of these people might benefit from flying in and working with somebody like that intensively for a few days, you know, and do some intensive work. And but Jeannie kind of specializes in transgender, gender issues, transitional issues, sexuality issues. She's probably one of the more informed certified HMR practitioners when it comes to sexuality and gender issues, things of that sort. She's worked with that. And she is certified. She's a supervisor. She could do a little supervision with her, asked to do a consult with her. Haven't talked to Jeannie in a couple of years, but I think she's still on my list, hasn't taken herself off. I think she was not real computer enthused about our software program. So I think she stepped back a little bit. She likes kind of traditional, you know, more handwritten stuff and things like that. But she is a psychologist and she does specialize in sexuality related kinds of issues. So that may be.
That's good to know. Okay, cool.
Yeah. Because I don't know if I'd have the answers. I haven't worked with that population a whole lot. And language is changing very quickly in that
field. I know. I'm trying to keep up with everything and it's very confusing for me.
Yeah, it's a little bit over my head too. So we need specialists, people that work with that regularly to be able to guide us through that and the reframing. But, I worked with people with doing transitional gender issues and have family members that are dealing with stuff like that now too. So, I've worked with a couple of specialists in the field that have given me their books on that subject. and have been reading on that. So, but I don't see it enough for it to be a regular theme at this point. But the bottom line is, when you clear the traumas and the abuse, whoever and whatever's left at the end of that is probably who you are and where you're headed.
That's what I told her too. I said, let's clear the traumas first, and then you can see, you'll feel more confident about where your direction is with us. Because I think
And if she does emerge with separate parts, or you see shifts in personalities, or they're not aware of each other's existence, you could be moving into DID territory, and that's might be over your head. Because DID will emerge over time, but they'll pop up and start showing up, and they won't be aware of each other's existence. So she'll lose days or times. Or in the manual, I talked about the DES, the dissociative spectrum. Okay. There's a test that's online that people can do to test to see how dissociative they are. That might be something you'd have her do to kind of test herself and see if she really is losing time or forgets things or doesn't remember who she is at times or how she got somewhere. If that's starting to emerge, it's reaching a little more dangerous level.
Okay.
But you don't have that occurring unless it's very severe physical or sexual abuse before the age of 5.
Okay, before 5.
So it would have to pretty much have occurred before 5.
I think it was right around then or right after.
It sounds like it's kind of close, like she's not close, quite grounded there.
Yeah.
That's good. Yeah, good question. That's a pretty heavy client, though, to be taking on when you're in training. So use supervisors, use Karen, use myself, use somebody. Yeah. The Jeannie is probably the closest to working with that with a lot of experience. She might be, and she's a supervisor, she might be good to consult with about that.
Okay, cool. Awesome. Yay.
Yeah, she'll charge you something. You have to ask what her supervision fee would be, but she's probably reasonable.
Okay. Perfect.
Okay.
Thanks.
Any other questions before we close? Thanks for hanging out. All right. Well, I'm going to keep breathing, get over my bronchitis, and we'll talk to you next month. Anything happening? No trainings this month in January. I'm in Maui next month for a healing intensive with Ray and Judy, doing a group there. And probably March, I'm doing a level 1 and 2 here in Tucson. So if you need a little tune-up or want to sit in, you know, or something like that, or if you need a refresher, it's always an option. Tucson's a nice place in March. If you need to thaw out and you're frozen, buried under feet of snow, and you can escape to the airport, feel free to flee down here and thaw out. It'll be right after the gym show, I think, probably. So, all right. Very good. Any other questions? You all look great.
When will you be
there?
What's that?
Thank you. When will you be there?
When will it be?
Yeah.
March. The dates are, the website has the updated schedule for 2020 on the website, but the actual dates of the training are.
I'm thinking about the time to go to get the test.
Oh, for testing? You mean you're thinking about doing the training and coming in for a test sometime?
No, I finished the training.
Okay, so about, as far as testing goes, you have to just call me and we can talk about that when you're able to come into Tucson. It just probably needs, unless I'm out your way sometime, but I'm not scheduled for Seattle yet for this year. Mm-hmm. That will probably happen at some point in time. But I haven't been in touch with Joyce or Helen to discuss a training in Seattle yet. If that occurs, that'd be the most convenient time to do it. I'm in Tucson. I just have to find when I'm not traveling. My travel schedule is online as far as that goes. So you can always see when I'm in Tucson if you need to come out here for that. There's a direct flight from Seattle to Tucson. It's pretty quick. Alaska Air flies in, flies out. So you can always fly in, do the exam, and head back out, something like that, if you have your materials finished.